If you want to deliver an Ohio voter's ballot on their behalf, it will not be as easy as dropping it into a secure Dropbox. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk about a new Ohio Supreme Court ruling that upholds an order from Secretary of State Frank LaRose, along with other election-related news. We'll also hear why Cincinnati's mayor says city council should reconsider how council replacements get appointed, and we'll discuss an amendment on Kentucky's ballot related to school funding and hear why only some schools are talking about it. Joining me now to get us started with the news review are USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you. And WVXU editor Jennifer Merritt. Thanks for being here, Jen.
Thank you.
So fun to have you in the studio. So, Jesse, tell us about how ballots must be delivered for voters with disability or others who can't make it to the polls themselves.
Yeah, so really at issue was how these drop boxes are used. And there are ballot drop boxes outside the county boards of elections that are monitored. And it's one way that voters can drop off their absentee ballots. Of course, you can mail them in or you can physically bring them in. But basically, the rule now is that you must drop off your own ballot if you're using a drop box. If you're dropping it off for someone else, whether that be someone with a disability or one of like your close relatives, that is allowed under Ohio law, you'd have to go into the County Board of Elections and sign a little form saying, you know, I am legally allowed to drop this off for this individual.
And so that means you'd have to go drop this off during hours that the Board of Elections is open.
Correct. That's another factor.
Yeah. Whereas the drop boxes are there, you know, 24/7. If you're dropping off your own ballot, you can swing by at midnight if you want to and drop it off in the drop box.
Yeah. If you're doing some errands and nearby, you can just put it in the box if it's your own ballot.
Okay. When and this, I understand this is a change or an interpretation rather of a directive that Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose issued. When and why did he issue this directive related to drop boxes?
Yeah, so I'll take you on a bit of a history. Ohio passed some changes related to ballots and elections and so forth in last year towards the, that took effect last year. One of them was requiring voter ID. And then we're also just kind of looking at who can drop off ballots for individuals. And so the Secretary of State put out some guidance. It was in response to a lawsuit that some individuals with disabilities provided that they brought. They were concerned that the list of people that could drop off ballots for individuals with disabilities wasn't comprehensive enough under this law. So they actually won that first lawsuit in federal court, which allows a larger group of people to drop off ballots for individuals with disabilities. After that lawsuit was settled, the Secretary of State had a directive that basically said, if you're dropping off these ballots for someone else, you need to come in and like file this attestation. And the goal is to prevent ballot harvesting, which is when you're collecting a bunch of ballots for individuals and kind of dropping them off. There's a concern that that can lead to voter fraud.
And this went to the Ohio Supreme Court. Tell us how the Ohio Supreme Court ruled on this.
Yeah, so the Ohio Democratic Party and then a number of other individuals who would be impacted by this directive filed a lawsuit. They said basically we should be able to use these drop boxes as we have previously without having to go inside, like you said, during business hours and filling out this form. The Ohio Supreme Court in a 4-3 decision said, you know, it's too late to take a look at this. People are already voting. We don't want to change the rules in the middle of the game. The four Republicans on the court, which included some substitutions because three justices who are up for election recused themselves. They decided not to review this case. But basically, the Republicans on the court said that. The Democrats on the court said, this is disenfranchising voters or limiting the number of ways that people can vote, and that's a bad thing.
And so was that concern from the dissenting justices, was it a concern that this could make it more difficult for people with disabilities to vote, or their family members to get their votes turned in for them? Or not only people with disabilities, older people and people who just can't make it to the polls.
Yeah, so Judge Bergeron, who was filling in for one of the other justices, said the directive issued by Secretary LaRose and the decision by the majority allowing it to persist sends the message that marginalized citizens may be safely relegated to the sidelines in our democracy. So there were some pretty fiery dissents on this one. Justice Jennifer Bruner said that the majority should have told the secretary that this violated his constitutional duties rather than upholding them. But right now, the balance on the Ohio Supreme Court is 4 Republicans and 3 Democrats. So on these more controversial issues, you're seeing that split come up quite a bit.
So this might sound like a dumb question, but how would the Board of Elections know if somebody drops off a ballot for a voter in a drop box after hours? I mean, if I can drop off my own ballot after hours, how do they know I'm dropping off mine and not dropping off, you know, my mom's or my or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's a good question for the County Board of Elections. The easiest way to tell would be if you're dropping off more than one ballot, but if you dropped off your ballot at 2 p.m. and then swung around and dropped off a different ballot at 10 p.m., these places are like video camera monitored and so forth, so they could look back on the record. But our County Board of Elections officials, who are already quite busy this time of year, going to have the time to do that. In practicality, it would probably be if someone complained and they would look into it.
That makes sense. How did Secretary of State Frank LaRose respond to this ruling?
Yeah, so he was very happy with the ruling. His statement was that political activists tried to, again, to dismantle the safeguards we put in place, specifically in this case against ballot harvesting. And so he was satisfied with what the Ohio Supreme Court ultimately said. So much of election law is this balance between election security and election access. And you're trying to hit that sweet spot. And based off your politics, you might lean one way or the other on these issues.
And there were some groups who were not happy. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, so people like the League of Women Voters were not satisfied with this decision. Obviously, the Ohio Democratic Party that brought the lawsuit was not thrilled. There's just been so much tension around the use of drop boxes. There are other states that have multiple drop boxes in different parts of the county. For example, Ohio limits drop boxes to one location, and it must be at the County Board of Elections. So drop boxes are always this topic that causes like strife and controversy before elections. So I suppose this is the latest iteration of it.
Will this directive automatically apply for future elections? Is there any chance it could be challenged again, especially considering the Ohio Supreme Court majority opinion said that timing was the problem?
Yeah, so typically directives are continued forward unless there's a different directive that changes them up. So I imagine this will be the case going forward, and it's possible that they could bring a different challenge, but the balance of the Ohio Supreme Court, I would be surprised if you would get a different ruling unless there's a different court.
Jen, you are here because you've been the mastermind behind the WVXU voter guide that's on our website. I encourage everybody to check it out at WVXU.org. What can people find out there in terms of like drop boxes in their communities? Can they find out information about that?
Yes. So we have links to the Secretary of State's websites in Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky, where you can find out all of that information. And just today, I was reading our reporter Zach Carrion's great article. He reached out to Disability Rights Ohio for some advice on how disabled voters should handle this, and they gave a phone number, which I will add to that voter guide. I'll give it here now, too. It's 1-800-282-9181, and that's the phone number for Disability Rights Ohio. So if you have questions or you have issues dropping off your ballot, you can give them a call. So that's relatively new information that we will add there as soon as I get off the air here.
There you go. And I think he said in his story that, people can even call that number on election day if they have questions.
Correct.
So good number to have. Well, Jesse, let's talk provisional ballots. What are they? How are they different from absentee ballots?
Yeah, so a provisional ballot is a ballot that you're going to cast if there's some sort of question about whether you're eligible to vote. And there's a variety of scenarios where this would come up. The big new one is if you don't have photo ID to vote in person, you are going to be asked to vote a provisional ballot. And then you'll have 4 days after Election Day to come into your county board of elections and bring your driver's license, passport, military ID, other form of identification that Ohio accepts. So that's the big new one. But it might be if you requested a mail-in ballot, an absentee ballot, and then you changed your mind and decided I'm going to vote in person either early or on election day. You can do that. They just want to double check that you haven't accidentally or intentionally cast two different ballots. So provisional ballots are, most of them are going to be counted. It's just they need to double check a few things before they count them.
I know another issue that can come up because one of our producers ran into this is if your signature doesn't look exactly like it does on your driver's license, because maybe it's gotten a little sloppier since you've gotten your driver's license. So all kinds of things can trigger a provisional ballot. Jen, does the WVXU voter guide have information about that, too? Does this do the Secretary of State's websites that you referred to have some kind of provisional ballot information?
Yes, they all have that information. It's you do have to work to find it, I'm not going to lie, which is kind of the point. And that, that's not to suggest that that's intentional. They'd have a lot of information that they have to put on their website. But that's kind of the point behind our election guides, is to make that information very easy to find for people. It's literally in like bulleted lists of like, are you looking for this? Here it is. Are you looking for this? Here it is. And so that we will have a little closer leading up to Election Day in a separate post, but that will be linked within our voter guide that you can find at wvxu.org/election2024.
Okay. Jesse, how can people make sure their vote counts if they do cast a provisional ballot? I mean, imagine some people might be kind of worried about that.
Yeah, so when you cast a provisional ballot, they should give you a form that says, hey, if you have any questions, this is the number to call. Or if you did need to bring additional information like your photo ID or proof that you changed your name, for example, where to do that and how to do that. So first of all, that should be there. But if you have any questions, you can call the County Board of Elections to double check the process. There are just kind of a variety of ways to make sure your ballot is being counted. It's worth noting that provisional ballots aren't counted on election day because they need to do those checks and make sure that you're eligible to vote. So they won't appear in the early unofficial results tabulation, but they will be counted even if they won't make a difference in the outcome of a race. Provisional ballots that are eligible are always counted.
There are some reasons that provisional ballots can be rejected, though, right? What are those, Jesse?
Yeah, so if you weren't registered to vote in Ohio, that was actually the biggest category last year of people who weren't counted. Now, voting can get you registered to vote for in the future, but it might not help you in this particular election. The other big reason last year was the photo ID issue. So it's really important that if you're going to vote in person, that you have some sort of photo ID. It doesn't need to have your current address, but it cannot be expired. So those are the key things. If you're voting via mail, you can actually use the last four digits of your social security number in lieu of a photo ID. But if you're coming in person, that photo ID is really important. Other things might be, you know, you went to the wrong precinct. They told you to go to the proper precinct and you just decide to vote there instead. That's a much smaller number, but things like that happen on election day. And particularly during presidential elections, when a lot of people only vote every 4 years or maybe every 2 years, it's a good idea to kind of refresh yourself on the rules.
And some voters do get removed from the voter rolls because they haven't voted in recent elections. Jesse, can they cast provisional ballots that'll be counted in the election?
So if you're not registered to vote, then you're unable to cast a ballot in this election. And there was a lawsuit that kind of accounted for some individuals who were removed but were still living at their same address. They were removed because they hadn't voted in a certain number of federal elections, but they were still living in the same place that they'd always lived at. There was a lawsuit that allowed those ballots to count between about 2019 and 2022, but that kind of ran out at the end of 2022. So it's very important to be registered to vote. The deadline to register to vote in Ohio has already passed.
Okay. Jen, I want to ask you more about WVXU's voter guide. Tons of election information there. What other kinds of things can people find there? We talked about how they're easy to use links to these Secretary of State websites and that sort of thing. What kinds of stuff can people find?
So they can find links to all of the interviews that we've done with the various candidates, including here on Cincinnati Edition. And where we did have some instances where candidates didn't respond, and we note that, and then we link off to their campaign website. So if you want to learn more about them, you can go and do that. As we talked about earlier, you'll also find links to the Secretary of State's website. Early voting dates. As Jesse mentioned, it's in full swing in Ohio and Indiana at the moment, and Kentucky starts next week on October 23rd. All of that information is listed there as well.
And what are some of the races and issues included in the guide? I know there are a whole bunch of them. Of course, we can't include every race because there are so many things on the ballot, but what are some of the races you'll find there?
Yeah, we've done our best to include a lot, and where we're a small but mighty team, and where we couldn't, we relied on our public radio partners at the Ohio State House News Bureau, Louisville Public Media, and Indiana Public Broadcasting. So, for in Ohio, for example, you'll find everything from the Senate race to Ohio Issue One, which I know is a hot topic, and then a lot from our partners at Indiana Public Broadcasting on the governor's race and the attorney general's race, two of which I think are actually kind of interesting this year. And same thing in Kentucky, right down to their Newport and Covington's commission candidates. They both have some races going on for various seats, and most of the candidates got back to us with their answers on the questions that we posed to them.
You mentioned that people can find the Cincinnati Edition election coverage. Here's my shameless self-promotion question for you. How can people access that Cincinnati Edition, those interviews that we did with candidates, if they're looking for that?
Yeah, so I would go down to, I'll say the Hamilton County Sheriff's race, for example. Those Cincinnati Edition interviews are linked within both candidates' individual pages. So, there's a lot of information out there, which is great. We're doing our best to make it easy to find. And I've said this before, if you use the voter guide, and I hope you do, and you have feedback, my email is available on the website. Please, please do send it to me.
There you go. And you mentioned this has information about Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. How tough is it to get all this information gathered and coordinated for a tri-state area? That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. We've been working on it for a couple of months now. So please know this isn't something that was thrown together in a day. And like I said, we just want to make sure people are getting the complete picture on everything. So we do our best to include all the information, even checking how to check to see if you're registered, and things of that nature. Any question any voter might have, we're trying to anticipate that and have that information there for you in that one spot so that you don't have to go out sleuthing for it.
Okay. Well, I want to come back to you, Jesse, because there are lots of races people in Ohio will see on their ballots. But people casting their vote for president in Ohio, they will see Green Party candidate Jill Stein on the ballot, but votes for her won't count. Why is that?
Yeah, so Jill Stein is the presidential candidate for the Green Party, and she had a placeholder name for her running mate when she initially filed, which was within the deadline. The name was Anita Rios. But later they chose a vice presidential candidate for Jill Stein, Butch Ware. And unfortunately, that happened after Ohio's deadline to change out the names on the ballot. So, based on this lawsuit that was filed, which I can explain, Jill Stein's campaign says that they were just going to leave Anita Rios on the Ohio ballot to make sure that their votes counted. But the Ohio Green Party sent some paperwork in to swap out the names to make sure the actual vice presidential candidate was listed. But because the deadline had already passed, they just took Anita Rios off the list. You can't run without a vice presidential candidate, ergo Jill Stein's votes won't be counted in Ohio. Now, the Stein campaign has filed a lawsuit in federal court that actually has a hearing next week that would require those votes to be counted. So it's still a little bit in flux, but that's kind of the whole journey that brought us here.
Huh. So at this point, and again, we've talked about how early voting is already happening. People might be casting their votes for Jill Stein in Ohio for her presidential campaign, and they don't know whether those votes will get counted at all.
Yeah, and because the Secretary of State is required to notify people that these candidates' votes won't be counted, if you got an absentee ballot, a mail-in ballot, it probably came with a little piece of paper saying votes for Jill Stein will not be counted. Certainly, if this lawsuit overturns that, we've kind of discouraged people from voting for Jill Stein. So it'll be interesting how this plays out. Ohio doesn't actually count its votes until Election Day. And so, you know, in theory, these votes could count if the lawsuit is successful. But right now, they're not going to count. So Jill Stein was a presidential candidate on the Ohio ballot previously. She received less than 1% of the vote. So this is not going to swing the election in Ohio, but it is an important question for supporters of Jill Stein in the state.
Well, we will count on you to follow that court case and let us know what happens with it. I've been talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Jesse Ballmert and WVXU editor Jennifer Merritt. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. And again, for more election information, check out the WVXU Voter Guide on our website, wvxu.org. Up next, should Cincinnati City Council change its policy for appointing replacement council members? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati City Council's newest council member was sworn in this week, and his appointment has drawn criticism. Now Mayor Aftab Purval is raising questions about how council replacements are appointed. Joining me now to talk about that and other news from this past week is Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Thanks for being here. So I mentioned Cincinnati City Council has a new member. We talked last week about the appointment of Evan Nolan to finish out former Councilmember Reggie Harris's term. There has been criticism about this pick. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's really caused kind of a firestorm among some members of the African-American community leadership. The NAACP, Cincinnati NAACP, came out earlier this week with a scathing statement about Councilwoman Mika Owens, who made this appointment. They basically criticized her. I'll just read directly from their statement. What they said was, what makes this even more concerning is that it comes from someone who, as a Black woman, has directly benefited from the very racial equity framework she now chooses to ignore. If she believes she hasn't benefited from those efforts, she is out of touch with the very processes that enabled her to walk through the doors opened by the sacrifices of others. And so they were, you know, this was as harsh a statement as I can recall from the NAACP. And so, you know, this happened earlier in the week, and there was, you know, quite a bit of criticism, and kind of culminated Wednesday, I believe, with a statement laid by Mayor Aftab Pirval saying, you know, I support, or he said basically that he believes Evan Nolan will be a good council member, but at the same time, he supports taking a look at maybe changing this process from the way that it works now, where council members designate one or more people to pick their replacement in case of their resignation, death, or removal, and looking at some other way of doing it.
Well, as I understand correctly, Evan Nolan previously served as the campaign treasurer for Mayor Pirval. Was the mayor involved in this pick in any way?
He says he was not involved. He also said that to two other council members, Victoria Parks and Scotty Johnson, both of whom kind of backed him up on that this week, or at least said that that is what he told them as well. So as far as we know, he wasn't involved. And this is kind of the second time Evan Nolan has been in the mix for an appointment. He was a candidate for the seat that was held by Greg Landsman after he was elected to council. Or elected to Congress, excuse me.
Yeah. What have other members of council said about this pick?
There's been a pretty tight-lipped other than Scotty Johnson and Victoria Parks. We asked Vice Mayor Jan Michelle Curdy, Lemon Kearney, about this. She kind of declined to get involved in this. But both Council Member Johnson and Councilwoman Parks, they said they were disappointed with the pick. They believed that, you know, it probably should have gone to an African-American man, and given that is what Reggie Harris is. You know, I think it's important to remember that in the council elections in 2023, there were, you know, the top five finishers were all African-Americans. And this was the first time in anyone's memory. I'm not sure it may be, if ever, that the African-Americans have had a majority of the members of council. So Mayor Aftab Pirval kind of mentioned that in his statement as well. So that's kind of driving the concern and the heartache over this, I think.
Well, because this appointment changes that, right? That now African-Americans no longer have a majority on council.
Yes, they would have, you know, they'll have four of the nine seats, and there are four white men and one white woman on council now.
You mentioned that Councilmember Meek.
And I should actually, I should also say that. Yeah, I should also say that. You know, while that's true, we don't see votes along racial lines. There aren't a lot of 5-4 votes or 6-3 votes anymore. But one of the recent 6-3 votes that actually did take place was on the connected community zoning legislation, and the African-American members were divided. There were two people who were in favor of it, Councilman Harris and Councilwoman Owens, and then three that were opposed to it. So it's pretty rare that we see a racial division on issues that face council.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Thanks for bringing that up. You mentioned that Councilmember Owens was responsible for choosing the replacement for Reggie Harris when he stepped down to take a job in the federal Housing and Urban Development, or Department of HUD is what I'm trying to say. How has Councilmember Owens responded to this criticism?
She's acknowledged it. She understands where it's coming from. Her position in appointing Evan Nolan is that she wanted a person who she believed would be able to really jump in the first day of work and knows the issues that that are facing council. He also said that one of his top issues is housing. As we all know, we have kind of a affordable housing problem in the city and even in the region. And he is somebody who wants to tackle that issue. And so she felt from day one that he could handle the job. The kind of the counterpoint is that the African-American men who were kind of on the short list, Gabe Davis, who's an attorney and now head of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, Ozzie Davis, who's kind of worked on housing issues in Avondale for a while. He's an Avondale neighborhood activist. And Derek Dansby, who is who's a realtor, also knows housing, I would say. So the pushback from others is that these are people who, you know, also know the issues and could be prepared from day one. You know, I think it's important, you know, Councilwoman Owens has kind of said she, in the intervening days here, she's, you know, she said she asked Evan Nolan to apply for the job and to take a look at it, and that he was someone she was looking at from kind of the get-go before other people tried, you know, started to, you know, make their interest known. So I think that's an important thing to know as well.
Yeah. Does she think the process should be changed in terms of how replacements are chosen or appointed?
She's willing to talk about it. You know, to be honest, we haven't really gotten into any substantive proposals on how that would be done. But I think that she is open to it as well. You know, she kind of has said this is something that came up unexpectedly. She did not realize that Councilman Harris was looking at a new job and likely to leave. And so she feels like she was kind of thrust into the spotlight. That being said, you know, when you're the designee who, you know, is going to be in charge of picking a person. So it could come at any time.
Yeah. Well, Evan Nolan was sworn in Thursday as a new city council member. Did he address this criticism in his remarks?
Yeah, he acknowledged it. He said he understands that he is not the first choice, but of some people. But he also pledged to listen to people and meet them where they are and try to understand their life experiences and where they're coming from. He said that's really the job of any council member. And, you know, he pledged to get to work doing that. He did acknowledge the criticism and the firestorm that has erupted. And he certainly knows that he's under a microscope at this point.
Well, let's move from city government to the county. I was reporting on stadium negotiations between Hamilton County and the Bengals in the late 90s and early 2000s, and there was some talk of a dome on the Bengals stadium even then. And now it sounds like that talk is back.
It is, and it's something that was talked about a year ago, 2023, when, you know, we started to talk about what would need to be done or what, you know, what might want to be done. Some people might want to be done to Paycor Stadium where the Bengals play. And it kind of came up in terms of a discussion of, you know, well, is this something that we should look at? And at that time, I did not feel like there was a solid commitment to look at that because it would be so expensive and difficult to put a dome on that stadium. But we learned this week for the first time that the county has actually engaged someone to, you know, take a look at this and study it and figure out the ins and outs and presumably how much it would cost and what it would take in order to do it. This was kind of the first time we knew that that was going on. The county's been really reticent about the details of this, though. We don't know who exactly is doing this study, whether it's, you know, whether it's the same companies that have, you know, been looking at and produced this $1.3 billion idea of kind of renovating the whole campus over there around Paycor Stadium, or, you know, we don't know how much the study is going to cost or any of that. So it's kind of a weird situation, but apparently it is going on.
So do we know, is this something the county is interested in, the team is interested in, or both interested in this?
We know the team is not interested in it. They've said that previously. They don't need a dome, they say. They don't need a new stadium. And so I don't think they're interested in that discussion unless their position has changed behind the scenes and not become public. But they have told me previously a year ago that they don't need a dome. So the county, I think, is bringing it up because the public is bringing it up. And there is also, of course, the discussion about building a new arena. And the thought, I think, is, well, is there a way to kill two birds with one stone by putting a roof on Paycor Stadium? And, you know, does that solve the arena problem? I think that the folks who want an arena would tell you it does not, because arenas are typically 15 to 20,000 seats and they're smaller, more intimate venues. So, you know, when you put a dome over a 65,000 seat stadium, that's not necessarily the same thing as building an arena. So, you know, I think the county is interested because some people have asked and because of this concurrent discussion about the arena.
What are some of the benefits of a dome from the county's perspective? I mean, you mentioned the arena, but would this be a way to get more big events to town? I'm thinking like the Taylor Swift concert that was such a big deal last year. I mean, would this, is that the idea that if you had a dome on that thing, you could get more big events like that year round?
I think that's exactly right. It, you know, it would have to be completely enclosed and climate controlled. Don't forget that. I mean, you can't just put a roof on it and then not have air conditioning or heat or particularly heat. If you wanted Taylor Swift to play in that stadium in, say, February or something. I've taken a look at this a little bit more. I haven't written another story, but since our story originally ran earlier this week, I've got to credit our colleagues at the Sports Business Journal, which covers the entire sports business industry, because they have looked at this a little bit more, for example, in Jacksonville, where they are going to do a stadium renovation of EverBank Stadium. And they are going to add a dome to it. And that is in the $1.4 billion transformational costs for that state. The thing that is interesting about what's going on down there in Jacksonville is that this dome is kind of made of a specialized, lighter weight material than typical roofs. But it will, you know, will cover the stadium. So when you have a rainy Florida day, which I think happens like once a day pretty much down there, it'll protect people from that. But it also will allow airflow, and that so it's not completely enclosed. And the way that they were able to do that down there is the foundation for that stadium is built in a way to accommodate the additional weight that would be put on it. So that's kind of a major question that we'll need to know about Paycor Stadium, whether it could support that. But the fact that they're doing a roof that doesn't really completely enclose the stadium, I'm not sure that would really add much to Paycor Stadium in terms of, you know, having events like Taylor Swift or the Final Four of men's college basketball in March. Our weather's pretty, you know, pretty spotty sometimes. So all of these are interesting questions that have to be answered, and they are surely going to cost in the nine figures, you know, probably more than $100 million would be added to any renovation cost by adding a dome to the stadium.
Mm. And is this something that came up recently? I mean, how did this come up? Was this a county commissioner who said, hey, should we look into this? Is that how this all came up?
I mean, originally, even a year ago, yeah, the Alicia Reese, Commissioner Reese, said she was interested in it. I think the other commissioners, you know, at least wanted to know more facts about it. And so, you know, at some point, apparently, the county administration, and like I said, details are a little sparse, but at some point, the, you know, county commission charged someone to do this work. And that's what's going on.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see where it goes. I've been talking with
absolutely.
And we will count on you.
It's
to
like
keep
the
us
never ender story, Lucy. Yeah.
Yes, it does feel a little bit like that to those of us who were here 20 something years ago. So I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, why some schools in Kentucky can talk about Amendment 2 on the ballot during school hours and others can't. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. When it comes to an issue on Kentucky's ballot, some teachers can talk about it during the school day and others cannot. Joining me now to explain why is WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Sure. And before we talk about that, I want to mention that we were talking about drop boxes and dropping off ballots for other voters earlier in our program. I am told that Hamilton County Board of Elections provides a drive-up service where you can fill out the paperwork needed to deliver a ballot for someone else without getting out of your car. That is still during business hours, I assume, but that is available. So, Zach, one of the issues on Kentucky's ballot involves school funding. Explain Amendment 2 and what it would do if it passes.
Yeah, so basically Amendment 2, dubbed the School Choice Amendment, kind of is exactly what it sounds. So it's not necessarily passing a school choice program, but it is basically changing Kentucky's constitution to allow for a school choice program, to allow lawmakers to create one under the current constitution right now. it can't. They have attempted to do one before, but it was ruled unconstitutional by Kentucky's court. So this is what Amendment 2 is, kind of creating a pathway for a school choice system.
Okay, and school choice being where lawmakers could pass legislation that would allow tax dollars to fund private or charter schools or private education in some way, education that is not in the public schools.
Public money to private schools and basically creating some sort of program to kind of facilitate that.
Okay. Who are some of the key supporters of Amendment 2? Who are some of the opponents?
Well, it's definitely a highly political issue, certainly. Democrats and Republicans are on different sides of the issue. Republicans leaning towards school choice, Democrats leaning kind of against that and support of public schools. Not always specifically political sometimes, but certainly that's generally where things are. But of course, a lot of people associated with public schools and working with public schools are against this amendment. And on the other side, you have a lot of religious groups and religious institutions that are behind this and want to say yes to Amendment 2. So that's kind of where things stand right now.
And as I mentioned, there's an important difference in how people in those camps, especially if they're working for public schools, working for religious schools, how they can express their opinions. Talk us through that.
Yeah, there's a big difference there. So people who work in public schools that might be against Amendment 2 aren't really permitted to talk about it within school hours or use school resources to advocate against it. Now, the reason is because they are public employees. They, you know, receive tax dollars and things like that. So they are not actually allowed to talk about campaign issues while on the clock, while using school resources. So that includes email. That includes if they have a cell phone, they can't really text about it using work-funded cell phones. So they are limited to what they can say about Amendment 2 within those confines. Now they can talk about it outside of school hours and dedicate time to it there. But as far as, you know, within school hours, school resources, they can't. Now, on the other side, you have churches and private schools who basically don't have any limitations at all. They can use their resources. They can use their money. You know, this can be online campaigns. This can be just putting out statements. But also we've heard from several people that they have been reading statements during church services and encouraging their congregations to vote yes on Amendment 2 at, you know, religious ceremonies. So certainly different rules there. You kind of understand the legal reasons why. But some people have certainly called foul about that because different rules on the same issue.
Yeah. You talked with a local bishop about this. What did he have to say?
Well, he said that Amendment 2 aligns with the church's stance on school choice. Basically, the church says parents should have the right to choose where their child goes to school, and they believe that Amendment 2 can facilitate that. So probably a couple months ago, the bishops came together. It's the Kentucky Catholic Conference, and they decided to release a statement and take a stance on Amendment 2 and make sure their congregation knew about it. So they are fully getting behind this and making sure their congregations know that the Catholic Church has a stance on Amendment 2, and it is vote yes.
Yeah. And the church can't endorse candidates, specific people, but it can legally make endorsements on issues like this, right?
Yeah. So they actually do have some rules, you know, for tax purposes mainly. But, you know, Bishop Iffert, who I spoke to at the Covington Diocese, says, you know, it's also kind of an ethical thing as well. So they won't endorse any candidates, but they will get behind certain political issues. We've seen this before, right? So it's Amendment 2 right now, but 2 years ago, it was the abortion issue in Kentucky as well. The Catholic Church, you know, wanted people to vote a certain way on that. So it's nothing really new. And I think, you know, sometimes what's happening with Amendment 2 in school choice right now, it might seem surprising because maybe people aren't necessarily making that connection between religion and school choice, but certainly the Catholic Church and churches across Kentucky want people to make that connection and know where the church stands.
And I know you also talked with someone from the Boone County Education Association. What's the association's position on this? Do they feel like this kind of puts public schools in a tricky position?
Yeah, well, I spoke to Kelly Reed from the Boone County, and basically what he said is you know, it's a bit unfair that the churches and private schools can speak about this kind of thing, but really when it comes down to public schools, they're kind of handcuffed on this issue. They can't really talk about it, and they're kind of relegated to kind of smaller conversations. So they talked about really person to person, talking to relatives, talking to family members, talking to people in their community directly about it outside of school. But yeah, they don't have the same reach. They can't use public school resources to have that kind of broader reach on this issue to reach their communities. It's on a much smaller level. And he definitely had some strong words for the church taking a stand on this. He says he doesn't believe that this should be part of the church's mission. He also said that, you know, the church should be looking out for the majority of Kentucky students, and most of them are in private schools. An overwhelming amount of them are
in public schools.
I'm sorry, an overwhelming amount of them are in public schools. So he says if the church is really looking out for the greater good, they should really be against this amendment.
Mm, interesting. Well, we will have a more in-depth discussion about Amendment 2 on Cincinnati Edition. We're going to have a supporter of the amendment and an opponent of the measure later this month. So people should stay tuned for that. I'm looking at the clock. I wanted to talk to you about another story you had this week. We're not going to have a lot of time. It's the latest with an investigation into special education at the Warren County Education Service Center in Warren County, Ohio. So, like, we have a minute left. I'm going to tell people to go to the website to read your story. Can you tell us just briefly what's next with this? There's a lawsuit. There's all this stuff going on. Are kids getting services? What's next with this?
So there are several lawsuits in this case, but I'll just talk about the most recent one. Basically, Disability Rights Ohio has been trying to get the state of the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce to enforce some sanctions on the Warren County Educational Service Center, basically over some accusations that they weren't providing adequate special education services. So this has been going on since 2021. We're now in 2024. They haven't really had success in state courts. They're taking the Department of Education to federal court, basically to say that they are violating federal education law by not enforcing sanctions on the Warren County Educational Service Center from their previous investigation.
Okay. And as I understand it, the Warren County Educational Service Center has said, hey, we think we're providing the services we need to.
Yep. They stand by that. They say that they are providing adequate services, and they have, and they still are.
Okay. A lot more information in your story on our website, WVXU.org. Everybody should look there. I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks for your time today, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.